Welcome to the deep recesses of space. Let's check in with a human.
Hello?
Hey, it's David Huntsberger from the Space Cave.
Whoa! Hey, Dave!
How's it going? You tweeted in your number and I didn't see it. You did it like a week ago.
Yeah. I was like up late and I saw that you tweeted me. Or you tweeted it out, and so I put my number in there, and I was like, oh, well, I guess it ran out or something, you know.
Yeah, I don't think it registered on my end until much later, so I'm sorry I missed that. I don't know what the lag time is through Twitter, but it must have been a bit.
Yeah, that's cool, man.
All right, cool. 505, where is that?
New Mexico.
Oh, cool. My parents met in Las Cruces. That's a dumb little thing about my parents, but I did spend some time there. I liked the mountains that are kind of in the backdrop, the college town environment, a lot of, wasn't there like dairies or something around there? It smells terrible just outside of town, right?
Yeah, it's out there going towards El Paso. There's a bunch of dairies on the way.
Yeah, what part of New Mexico are you in?
I'm in Las Cruces right now.
Actually. Oh, okay. Whoa. So it is kind of a small world.
I'm originally from Roswell, but I've been in Las Cruces for like, what, since 2012 I've been here.
Oh, did you say Roswell or Roswell?
Roswell.
Like the alien area?
Yeah, that's right.
You must get asked about that all the time. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah.
All right. Well, I won't burden you with that treaded path of conversation. What's on your mind? What's got your attention these days?
I just graduated college.
Congratulations!
I got my business. Yeah, thanks. I got my business degree. It took me 5 years. But
that's okay. I'm done with that. Okay, and what are you going to do with the business degree?
Well, I kind of like fell into this job repairing appliances. And I really like it, and my boss is really old. He's going to pass the business down to me. He's going to sell it to me when he says he can't do it anymore. That's what he alleges anyway, but I trust him. I believe him.
Yeah.
But, on my mind lately, I kind of like got, now that I'm done with school, like I start like, I don't know, reading books again and stuff, you know? Like I want to know more about socialism, you know? With Bernie.
Mm-hmm.
In the spotlight and everything, like I think my middle name's Ernesto. I was named after Che. Well, my father named me Che.
Oh, cool.
And I don't know, for the longest time I felt like this country really treated socialism like worse than, I don't know, atheists, you know. I've just been kind of like delving into all things Marxist and whatnot.
Did you, like, when you say it treated the country treated it that way, was it something that you had kind of a blind prejudice toward? Because we do that when we're raised, you know, you just suddenly start, I don't like that. Why? I don't know. Everyone around me doesn't like it.
I noticed the blind prejudice, you know, because, you know, I'm Mexican and, I don't know, the political leanings, you know, it's not just neoliberal and neoliberal light, you know?
So I guess, like, you haven't started reading yet, or you have? Like, what appeals to you about it? Just the idea of looking out for people a little bit more?
I don't know. I kind of see it as, I haven't really, apart from, like, really long blog posts and stuff, I haven't really got any books yet. But what's gotten my attention, it's like a reawakening, you know, because I think for the longest time, the powers that be. Well, there's this guy, Richard Wolff. Are you familiar with him? The professor?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Well, like his is like, I've watched a lot of, he's got a podcast and I've watched a lot of his YouTube videos. And he's an economics professor who went to Yale, he went to Stanford, and he went to Harvard, Yale, and Stanford.
Okay.
He said, not once in those three institutions studying economics did they go over the works of Karl Marx. Like, the way he explained it, he was annoyed with people as of late coming up with him, like, since 2008, been coming up asking him about socialism because, you know, we just have a cut in the dark. And he's gone from being annoyed to, like, he does, like, talks in New York, and he's just a great speaker. I don't know. I think the future is bright when it comes to class.
Good. Oh, that's good to hear. I lose sight of it a little bit being in Los Angeles, and then I haven't been touring as much lately to get, like, a good cross-section of how everyone feels, you know? And even when you go to a different town, you know, you're in a comedy club, which is a decent way to look at it, but, you know, it's nice to get a chance, you know, to talk to somebody to hear how they feel, and I'm glad you feel optimistic about it. And then how do people around you bring it up with people around you in Las Cruces? It's kind of a blue-collar part of the world. I mean, I would imagine people there have, but it's also close to the border, so I would imagine there's, like, a variety of different, you know, sentiments and opinions down there.
I think, you know, rural America is still getting used to the Reagan, or they're still getting over Reagan, I should say, you know, like, the effects of his administration. Mm-hmm. It's just very elementary, I think. People still, I think the big problem is people, they mistake authoritarianism with communism, I think. Communism equals authoritarianism, like, even, like, some smart comics who will, like, I, you know, listen to their podcasts and stuff, and I think they make a mistake. Like, you know, they'll be like, you know, Fidel Castro and Ho Chi Minh and Stalin, you know, that's what you get whenever, you know, communism comes into the question. And
all right. Well, I want to know more about this stuff too. So I think a good idea would be you go read those books and then come back and be a guest or chat, call in again with a better phone connection, and then you can tell me and fill me in on what is the best economic system to put in place and how we can get things on a better track where everyone is accounted for and respected and treated well, and it also doesn't put a tremendous burden on everyone who's, like, you know, working and stuff. I think that's probably right. The biggest I'm sure that's where the dissension comes from and all that, but yeah, man, go let me know what books you're reading, and I'll check back in with you down the road. How's that sound?
That sounds awesome, man.
All right, cool. Well, thanks, Artie. It was good chatting with you. And I'm curious, too, when you're going to take over the appliance business. I know you'll do well at it.
Thank you. I like the job a lot. So.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks for calling, or thanks for tweeting in your number. Talk to you soon.
Sure. Later, man.
Okay. See ya. That was Artie. You can follow him on Twitter. Just look at the Space Cave Twitter, and then you'll probably see his. He emailed me afterward to say that he was a little stoned during our chat. So I hope you can hear it okay, and I hope that his being stoned didn't affect it. And if you know a lot about socialism, let me know. And we can pass that information along to Artie and to everyone. We should all know our economic systems, right? Yeah, perhaps. Okay, let's get into it, you guys. This is the part one of my conversation with someone who's very patient to be on the show. Originally he had emailed to be a guest on Professor Blastoff. Sadly, didn't make it onto the show before it ended. But he works in film restoration, and I thought that was, honestly, if I'm being honest, when I first started, I was like, that doesn't sound all that interesting. But then I talked to him. He came to a junk show. We talked more about it. And then I was like, oh, that's very interesting. I was being a bit of a clod. I never say that word. Clod? Who calls people clods? I guess Iggy Pop? Who knows? Anyway, I was being a little bit narrow-minded. And so he came on. He's not much of a drinker, but he was nice enough to. He said, I like this, like, sort of chocolate stout or something like that. I couldn't really find it, but I found the Samuel Adams beer. You'll hear us discuss it in the episode. And we sat down and chatted about archival techniques and methods and his life and how he got into it, and it's pretty fascinating. I really enjoyed it. So here's part one of my chat with Samuel B. Prime. Okay, back in the sweet spot.
Back in the sweet spot.
Back for our...
Oh, yeah.
Whoa, that's good.
Thank you.
So, Samuel B. Prime, what's the B stand for?
It stands for Bishop.
Ooh, nice. That's a fancy name.
Thank you.
Samuel Bishop Prime.
I used to make people guess it all the time, and it would just be an unending game that would just frustrate whoever I was speaking with to a point that they would never speak to me again.
I don't doubt it, because people typically have a threshold of, what, 8, 15, 27 guesses?
That's very generous.
You think, like, 7. 7 total guesses.
And maybe, like, all right. 5. Maybe 5 guesses, and then it would be like, please, please just tell us.
Yeah.
Because we will actually never guess.
Well, I was playing this game recently called, I think it's called Scattergories. You played that?
I have played Scattergories, although my memory of the rules is very fuzzy.
I'm about to brush you right up to speed. So you
bring me into that sweet spot.
I'm gonna put you right in the sweet spot of Scattergories. You roll this maybe 12-sided? Or no. You roll, it's 26-sided. It's every letter in the alphabet.
It's like Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. It's a mystical... You don't put it down the castle-y thing, though, to roll it. You can just roll it right out of your hand.
That's not Dungeons and Dragons at all.
I thought some people in Dungeons and Dragons, like, drop it in the top of a castle, and then it rolls.
You are sorely mistaken.
I've seen that. I know I've seen it, but
perhaps... I want to play that version of the game. It's not nowhere near as exciting as dropping dice down castles.
All right. I digress. I must have confused it for an even more exhilarating game. Are you besmirching Dungeons and Dragons?
No, it is actually, it can be a very entertaining game. I used to play a little bit of that in, like, middle school and high school.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's primarily, you know, you're relying on your imagination and sort of the whims of whoever is the storyteller of the game. You know?
Okay. Anyway, back to Scattergories,
oh, yes.
Which also involves your imagination and whims. You roll this 26-sided die as a letter of the alphabet, and then as soon as the letter is rolled over, say, you know, it's T. T is, that'd be a good one to get. And if you can't use the, then you have a card that has 12 blank spaces, but next to each blank space is type of sports car, type of tree, sports team name, etc., to fill up 12. And then you have to pick a bunch of them that start with T. You would think that would be easy. There are hundreds of each thing. And yet when you start doing it, you find yourself blanking because... And that must be happening when people are trying to guess that B. And Bishop's way down deep in there.
I agree. I mean, that's part of what I found so delightful about the game is that I knew it. I had it in my pocket that no one is going to guess Bishop right off the, you know.
What's infuriating is they would probably guess Bob, that your parents gave you a
Bob?
Nickname
really?
For a middle name.
I don't think so.
No one guessed that?
No,
okay.
No. I mean, it was very pedestrian.
Okay. Well, I was giving
typically
your...
Typically very pedestrian guesses, I would say.
Okay. Like Bartholomew, would that come
Bartholomew came up a lot.
That's a reasonable middle name.
It is. It's a very good one. It's a strong name.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend whose first name was Bartholomew and insisted on going by the full name,
mm-hmm.
not any kind
of
abbreviation.
Oh, that sounds like an unpleasant person.
He was actually a very kind and reasonable man. Still is.
You hear that, Bart? And then he's furious. Not that kind and reasonable. Because he'd be
he grew to accept the abbreviation,
oh, okay.
I think.
I can get both schools behind that. Some people, hey, my parents named me this, don't you shorten. You don't get licensed to do what you want with my name.
Sure.
I feel like your name belongs to you, but I can call you what I want. It's more endearing or affectionate.
Sure.
So there are definitely two schools of thought there, but it'd be hard to hang out with someone that, please, it's Bartholomew and nothing else.
Yeah, his personality made up for that insistence.
It's weird because the only thing I know about his personality is that weird Bartholomew quirk.
Well, yes, but I did say he was kind and reasonable.
Yeah, I know. I'm coming around on Bartholomew.
All right.
But let's really address this delicious beverage we're drinking. This Sam Adams, what's it called? 25th hour?
13th hour?
13th hour chocolate dark stout? Something like that.
Okay.
I haven't had a ton of Sam Adams. I've had, like, their basic one and then, like, a couple of maybe their seasonal things. They're all right.
Yeah, yeah. My experience with Sam Adams is similarly slight but positive.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, this one, Oh, that is nice. It doesn't taste that chocolatey.
No, it is creamy, though.
Yeah. I'm drinking mine out of my ancient ceramic mug from Brett Kern. I don't think this episode has come out yet, so that's totally confusing to you, but he does ceramics based out of Elkins, West Virginia, and was nice enough to send me this mug, so it's become the official container. What's a better word for container? Transport device?
Gosh.
Ah, that's terrible.
No, goblet.
The official goblet for me is this wonderful blue mug. I like it. Yeah, I can drink more of this.
Yeah.
I don't know what I was expecting.
It is having a warming effect right here in the center of my being.
Oh, I'm not getting that.
Oh.
What in the heck? Oh, no. Maybe the blue mug doesn't have
You take one sip or two?
I went with one.
Oh, well, I took a second while you weren't looking, so that could have been it. I think with the second one.
Oh, you're right. Yep.
There it is.
Yeah.
There it is.
It's warming me right up.
All right. You know where it's warming me up?
Right in your middle section?
I would call it the sweet spot, but...
Oh, yeah. Damn it. How did I miss that?
That's okay.
Why we named our show that.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we're the sweet spot. And you were nice enough to reach out and say, hey, I want to come on the sweet spot. I want to start a podcast called The Sweet Spot with you and talk about film restoration and archival things. And before we get into that and the film that you brought that I have here, Catch My Soul, a unique motion picture experience, which I have yet to watch, but I will. I think the description of it threw me off a little bit. It's like a rock opera, and I'm just rarely in the mood to sit down and commit to that. But I don't know, it looks pretty cool. 60s hippie era, trippy psychedelic stuff. I'm assuming it's something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a film that I've been completely obsessed with for about the past 7 or 8 years.
Oh, wow. So this wasn't a whim. This was I love this and I'm sharing it with everyone.
It was initially very much a whim.
Mm-hmm.
The story is kind of a long one, but back when I was an undergrad at Northwestern University, I was taking a class basically for the credit called Shakespeare and Music, which I thought would be fun and kind of light and fluffy. And it certainly was both of those things. And there came a point where the professor had assigned to us that we needed to write a short paper about any kind of film adaptation of Othello.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of 2 to 3 pages. Don't really worry about it. Write about it. Find something that you love and write about it. And I heard about this film called Catch My Soul, which was described to me when I heard about it first as a 1970s rock and roll musical version of Othello starring Richie Havens. And I was like, what? Richie Havens, of course, is most famously known for opening Woodstock and just playing and improvising all these great tunes, which, carried him throughout the rest of his career. And
be careful with
hits.
Your mic. It's making a little, I think the cord is making a little noise there. I'm sorry.
And
the
moment that I heard that this thing existed, I was like, this is what I have to write about. And I tried to find as much information about it as I possibly could and did write this paper based on the information that I could gather within, say, a week's time.
Yeah. And this is, what year is this? To give people an internet reference.
Sure. So the year... The year the film was made or the year that...
Well, no, when you were doing this would have been 2008-ish, 9-ish?
This would have been around spring 2008.
So the internet's in good shape then. You got a pretty large resource there.
Yeah. So there's enough information to construct a paper out of this title. And I'm just blown away by this. It's Richie Havens as Othello. A guy named Patrick McGowan directed the film. It was the only film he ever directed. And there's just tons of crazy people, both cast and crew, involved with this thing. So I wrote this paper, turned it in. The professor just blows her mind. She just brings it up the first thing in class the next week. She's like, how do you know about this movie? Where did you find it? Apparently, unbeknownst to me, the film has been thought popularly to be lost for the last 40 years.
Oh, crazy.
And for this assignment, we were supposed to have watched the movie adaptation that we wrote about.
Uh-huh.
I did not watch the movie. It is difficult to watch a film that is completely inaccessible. And I basically sort of faked my way through that very awkward classroom experience.
Oh man, you had the makings of like an 80s movie where you're getting an F unless you come up with that movie.
Well, the professor was so excited that I think she sort of blindsided herself. I was like, oh yeah, I think I just saw clips online somewhere. But after sort of making my way through that, my fascination with the film was very genuine. And I basically began, you know, several months after that, what would become several years worth of like research into this movie about how it was made, how it was lost, and then turning it into a senior thesis at Northwestern. And then many, many years later, with the collaboration of some people who are great, great friends of mine, work in the distribution business, and some of the people who worked on the film originally, sort of behind the scenes, we were able to get the film released, which is the first time it's ever been available on DVD, Blu-ray, any kind of home video. Ever.
And that was in 2015.
Yeah.
Now I feel like a real heel that I didn't watch it. In my head, when I saw it, I thought, oh, this is one of those movies that, like, not necessarily that Mystery Science Theater would make fun of, but just that, like, it's in a pile at every yard sale or in a thrift store. It's just, and not knowing that, like, this was the Ark of the Covenant. This was a strange thing that you had to fight tooth and nail to somehow get. Because I saw on the back cover, it one of the copyrights is 2015. So
yeah, it's I mean, it's a curious journey from that initial classroom in 2008 to 2015 and getting the film finally released and available to purchase anywhere. You're not totally incorrect in saying that this is kind of an item that might have been found in someone's garbage bin.
That's why it became obsolete?
Well, the sort of part of the history of this film is, and especially what's so fascinating, is that when it was initially released in New York City, it did not do well at all. Mm-hmm. It was released in one theater in New York City right around 1974, and on the opening night, the producer, his team of loyal fellas who were totally in love and enamored with this film, rightly so, went to see it. Opening night, 7:30 showing, they showed up empty theater with the exception of seven nuns who had heard the film was religious in nature, and it is, alongside the Othello story. And they just were baffled, you know, totally heartbroken, and they knew that the film was not going to do any business. Which
the nuns were heartbroken too.
Well, I think the nuns found what they were looking for in the film, but they didn't really spread the word amongst the convent, apparently, because the film did not do business and was not particularly well received critically. I think part of that is due to some trouble with miscegenation at the time, some sort of crabby opinions. And
is that part of what draws opinions. You to it, that it was kind of slipped through the cracks? And
absolutely, I mean, I think Catch My Soul for me was a real beginning fascination with films that have fallen off the map, lost films, things that are sort of buried far deep down in that well of esoterica that people don't know about, and that might be spectacular, and that if they are, I want to shine a light on those, you know? And with the help of colleagues and friends, you know, with Catch My Soul, we were able to do that. But I have to say, at the culmination, this is around March of 2010, at the culmination of my senior thesis at Northwestern, we actually were able to get a copy of the film on film and video to watch, the first time the film had been shown anywhere in nearly 40 years. And it was just myself, my advisors, and like some close buddies watching that film for the first time without having ever seen anything except photographs and reviews and hearing a little bit of the music disconnected from it was so nerve-wracking. I said, my short speech to friends and colleagues before we showed that was, this could be terrible. My research could end here, and this film might never ever see the light of day because it is truly terrible. But then we watched it, and it was delightful.
Just delightful, or like mind-changing, or earth-shattering, or
not earth-shattering. But the film was so consciously, artistically driven, and so thoughtfully constructed that its box office failure and its failure with the critics, who really sort of attacked this, really attacked the performers and the nature of the songs more so than anything else. It was more than the sum of these sort of component parts that I was able to assemble, mm-hmm. not having seen the film. It was really a much more thoughtful film than the historical record or the sort of semblance of a historical record might have shown.
Oh, okay. It has all the makings of definitely like one of those if you were doing a farcical thing of a terrible director who's going, I want to make a rock opera based on Othello, and they go, oof.
It all does right. sound like a kind of wild idea, and I think that's part of why I was so drawn to it at the beginning. It was like, it's Othello, but like set in a desert and like with hippie music, and and you know, there's some other sort of notable crew members involved too, like Conrad Hall, who won multiple Academy Awards, but is probably best known for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, photographed the movie, and the film was edited in part by Richard A. Harris, who later worked on Terminator 2, Judgment Day, and won for Titanic.
So are you...
There's a whole host of notable people involved, and so there's a kind of historical curiosity to it that goes well beyond this sort of Shakespeare narrative and this really
yeah.
cool hippie soundtrack.
Well, for historical elements, you have to be familiar with that. I mean, for most people, they don't even air a lot of like the Emmys or the Oscars, that the general population wouldn't really know about, you know, technical things, sound editing and things like that, that a lot of people I think would kind of go, huh, what? And yet there are whole maybe forums online, people dedicated to like, here's why this person is the greatest at this. Were you always that way as a kid? Like, what, give me a little bit of an idea of your background of like how you got, I notice you call them films, which is a distinction I get. A lot of people go, oh, I went to the movies. Why are they films? Why did you always love them? How did you always as a kid know, like, oh, you know who's the DP on this movie? I mean, children don't really talk to each other that way. Like, oh man, that guy's the best sound mixer in the business. You know, how did you get into it?
Yeah, all good questions. I would say...
You can take your time, too. Just, you know, you don't have to go the whole way. Samuel, please.
Okay. No, I would say that I'm not such a snob about always calling them films first. I do say movies or flicks or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think films is just sort of the default. You know, it's like where my mind goes. It's just like, oh, talking about a film, talking about a movie.
I've never liked flick. It never made any sense to me.
I think that particular, version of film or movie kind of comes up when I'm doing like a radio announcer type of a voice, you know, going to the old Nickelodeon or something, you know?
Yeah, I get you. Okay. Yeah, I don't know what I associate it with. There must have been someone in my childhood who said, like, that was a good flick. And I just,
maybe it does have a kind of macho.
Something. Yeah, there's something there. I never really.
Ethos behind it.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. So are your parents film nuts, or are you from Illinois originally?
No, I'm actually from Michigan originally.
Okay.
So from kind of a small town in the Midwest, and neither my father nor my mother are like super film nerds, but you know, my father would always take me to go rent movies very frequently, and particularly early on, mm-hmm. introduced me to older films. So I was seeing oftentimes films like from the 1930s and the 1940s, while people who were my age and comparatively normal were probably seeing cartoons, you know?
Yeah.
Seeing a lot of like Universal Horror Pictures and Abbott and Costello films, and really kind of falling in love with that stuff.
And that's something your dad would primarily take you to go see?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
did he harbor a sort of feeling of, was there ever, I don't know why, you know, it seems like this is necessary, but a child, when I was a kid, my dad took me to movies and then said this to me. Was there ever like, son, no, pay attention. Was there anything like that? Was there an ethos behind it?
I don't think there was anything so intellectual behind it. I think it was just, there may have been something in the way of, these are the kind of films that I saw when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will sort of present them to you. And if you like them, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Like, we can see more of them. But I think it was through those initial films that I became curious about others and would spend hours and hours just browsing the shelves and like kind of letting my imagination go wild with the possibility that lied beyond what like a box art cover would mean.
You know? Yeah.
I can even still remember that like a film that I only saw as recently as 6 months ago, Children of the Corn, 20 years ago, seeing that box cover, mm-hmm. being terrified of it and thinking, I'm never going to watch that movie.
Yeah.
When in reality, the film is actually quite silly.
It's really silly. And then that little old man kid.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. And they crucify him at one point.
Yeah. Is he Damien? I think he might be.
I forget the character's name, but I mean, the film is really outrageously funny.
Yeah.
But even just like the cover of that picture, and especially living in Michigan, where a part of Michigan where like the main crop is like corn and there are cornfields literally surrounding my house, not a movie that I want to watch. like at least in theory, like yeah. seeing that box cover and like a scythe coming up over the cornfields, I'm like, nope, that's yeah. gonna give me nightmares.
That one and Pet Sematary were the same for me as a kid, where everyone associated them with being like the scariest movie imaginable, and I'd seen Nightmare on Elm Street and people go, oh, Children of the Corn, it's way weird, it's just creepy, and then I didn't watch it, same reason, like, well, I don't want to see that. And then years later when I did, when I was like an adult, I mean, they're both just terrible and silly. I know a lot of people go, oh, those movies are great, they're great because they're so bad. Like I did not enjoy them. I feel like it's a huge waste of time, but there are a lot of people that enjoy just that silliness, like, oh, isn't it crazy how bad this movie is, this is enjoyable. Like The Room kind of took off that way, and
I really tend to resist that kind of so bad it's good vibe from movies. I think, you know, The Room is a great example of that type of film. Mm-hmm. But I really think the idea of kind of joining with an audience to sort of make fun of something has a real kind of negative quality to it that doesn't really benefit anybody. I think more from my perspective, watching those like 30s and 40s films with my father, I think that inspired a kind of natural curiosity.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once I was able to sort of sift through and watch nearly everything that I, you know, sought out for myself at our local video stores, it sort of was like, well, what's the next step? Like, where do I go after this?
And that, I think, to me is, sorry to cut you off little bit, but like, I read this article about this family that had, you know, something crazy, like 8 kids who were all either college graduates or early entry college bound children at age like 14, and just crazy levels of success that they had achieved. And the parents were kind of talking about like, well, this is how we did it. Like, we just identified what our children's curiosities were, what they were passionate about, and then just asked them about it. If our children were playing video games, it was never just purely to get them out of our hair. We would come over and be like, what do you like about that game? Why do you like it? Do you like that you're having to get somewhere? If you were going to design this game, what would you change? And giving them something to go, oh, I could do this? Yeah, here, let's get you involved in that. And it doesn't seem like your dad had that level of thing. And I'm also surprised, like a lot of people that watch a lot of films growing up, when you think of like Quentin Tarantino or J.J. Abrams, you know, this like archival knowledge of like, oh, I just grew up watching tons of stuff. Of course, then they seemingly like the next step is, oh, I want to make them, I want to direct them. But for you, like, why the, you have, like, then you were just starting to talk about the next step. Like, was directing those things, why weren't they the next step?
I think for me, it was wanting to dig much, much deeper into film catalogs and to know more than was just on the shelves and available in a small Midwestern Michigan town.
Yeah.
And so I think with music as well, it was about starting to identify, well, what is really out there, and like, what kind of films do exist that I'm not even aware of yet?
And why the pursuit of them? Do you feel like there's a consumerism marketing element to the things that get surfaced up to the top are just pushed in front of us? And you have this, I can identify with that, like this feeling that like there must be so much more down below, the things that we don't see. And there's probably some real jewels down there.
Yeah. I mean, I just think that, that my personality and my temperament does not necessarily like to go with the flow as far as like top 40 radio is concerned. Yeah. And like, don't get me wrong, like I love like a well executed big blockbuster picture. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, a couple of years ago, the movie Dread that came out in 3D, like, I think that is a spectacular movie and is incredibly successful in what it's doing. But I think that I am particularly drawn, you know, having the sort of, distance of time and space between my childhood self and the contemporary moment. Like, I know for me right now that, like, my wheelhouse in terms of cinema is, like, obscure, esoteric films, most likely from the early 1970s. Like, my wheelhouse for films is usually, like, 73 to 75 and films that you probably haven't heard of.
I'm sure.
And it's just what titillates me. It's what, you know, makes my mind do cartwheels. And showing them to other people, uh-huh. you know, through film programming and home video distribution and theatrical. I mean, it's what brings you joy, you know, or it's what brings me joy. And I think that's what you're looking for in any pursuit.
In life, yeah. I mean, you want to, people would talk themselves out of that if they were like, you know what really makes me happy is like bagging groceries. People go, you can't do that. But the person would be like, I genuinely love it. I like the challenge bag after bag.
I would love to see a movie about someone for whom that is true.
Because, I
think it would be spectacular.
Anyone that's passionate about what they're doing and really has vested interest, you can't help but be like, I'm impressed by that. And that some, like, archiving, seeking out, compiling these collections of old films is a, if that person were in a book, you would think that it was assigned to them as a job. And it's, and not to like slight you in any way that saying that, but I mean, it just, there seems to be something like, I picture someone in a deep, dark, dank sort of warehouse, bottom, like labyrinth style basement of a facility, just going through and tagging things and sorting them. And yet there's a real joy in that if you're going like, wow, these all exist. I found them. You're like someone stacking their diamonds. Like, oh, look at this collection I got going.
Yeah, the hope would be not to simply collect and store and hoard for selfish safekeeping, but really, to celebrate and enjoy something that maybe wasn't given its critical praise or due in its own lifetime, you know? And for me, like, having learned so much about Catch My Soul over the years, I realized that, you know, it began as a musical and a play initially that was actually quite successful both in London and in the United States, actually even here in California at the the Center Theater Playhouse, I believe. Mm-hmm. And in London it was the Roundhouse Theater. And the man who was responsible for it was a guy named Jack Good, who made a name for himself in Europe doing sort of musical variety shows, the European equivalent of American Bandstand.
Oh, okay.
And he was very well known, very big in the music business, still is considered so today. And for him...
But is this what you like? Do you like knowing this level, like these sorts of... Because to me, this goes really far down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, admittedly. Admittedly.
And I find it interesting, but I also am kind of like, where's this going? Like, this...
It is going somewhere, I promise.
Okay, sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's okay.
But there's an interesting... Like, the dynamic at play with what you're saying and what you do is interesting to me because, like... That's a component of it. Like, having that level of knowledge, is that something that really like appeals to you? Like, I like that not a lot of people know this.
That, I mean, I think there is a value to a judgment to place on that, but only in the sense that, like, I would put it on a resume, you know.
Yeah.
It would be for a professional context only, not for like bragging rights. That would be silly.
Okay, sorry.
What it comes down to is I think like those early video store experiences and watching sort of 30s, 40s movies and sort of moving up to more contemporary films and really just learning to sort of explore the video store on my own, I realized very quickly that like, oh, what I love is movies. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what I'm interested in more so than anything else. And how can I explore that as fully as possible? And in the context of Catch My Soul, learning so much more about that and learning about Jack Good and his history, what became clear is that for Jack Good, the film version of Catch My Soul was his ultimate gift to the world. Like, it was the thing that for him was the most important creative act, and it was a failure. It was not received well at all. It was shunned everywhere it went. And eventually, after he sort of took his name away from it and disappeared, the film was sold to New Line Cinema, who then re-released the picture under the title Santa Fe Satan. So that tells you how much respect they had for it.
A rock-based opera, a rock opera based on Othello, could be termed Santa-faced Satan.
It does have a kind of religious aspect to it, where the Iago character is sort of an allegory for the devil himself. But for me, aside from simply being obsessed with Catch My Soul and delighted that it was not a lost film and in fact did exist, and was able to be restored, thankfully, for me it was most importantly about putting something back out into the world that was this man Jack Good's chief creative effort.
It was his baby. It was his passion and life.
And it was, in the best intention from my perspective, from my colleagues, and with, you know, all the appropriate hope in the world that people would sort of see the same things that we did, it was an effort to justify a man's own creative effort and thought, you know, to justify that he was actually right and created something beautiful.
I love that. And if I can be, if I can divulge to you, this is a little bit vulnerable, I guess, but you're always hoping, like, when you make stuff, that there's someone like you who might catch it if it does fall through the cracks. You know, like, I made this, or we, animators and artists, made this stand-up special that I really feel we put everything into.
Which is great, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you. That's all. That's the only reason I was getting into it. But I mean, I feel like every frame of it is something we cared about, you know, that there's art or something in the background, or you know, the lighting, there's something in every moment of it that we were very specific in trying to get the costuming and where people were placed and the amount of things we made. And it does have that feeling of, like, when you're just exhausting yourself, like, but did we think of this? What if, oh, we're missing a chance here to take advantage of being creative and making that and doing it. And then, you know, there were places that reached out and said, hey, we'll help you promote it, then never really did. And there's an avalanche of content kind of coming every day, and when it gets swept up in that, you can only hope that, like, after the avalanche goes and there's a chance for it to kind of settle, that someone will dig down through there maybe and find it and go, hey, this got passed over, but this is okay. Why did this never, like, wasn't this on the front end of the avalanche at all? And so I think it's so fascinating that, like, if, like, Jack Good's name is being mentioned on a podcast 40 years later because what he did have some merit.
Yeah.
It did matter to you.
Absolutely. And the fact that the film sort of sat dormant for so long without any kind of action or attempt to get it out there, I mean, is such a long and complex and needlessly circuitous story that I don't even want to go into it. It's mostly, it's not emotional in terms of the story. It's mostly just legal objects changing hands and intellectual property.
All the worst things.
All the most complex, hard to navigate sort of things you can imagine. But yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's 2016 now. We were able to do a lot of good work and get it out there. And I'm happy to say that, you know, Jack Good is still alive. He's in his late 80s now. And I was able to have a couple of conversations with him after years of working on this thing. And
you know, does he feel about it? Is he kind of detached, like, oh, that old thing? Or did he still light up a little bit?
I mean, I think I alluded to this before, but I mean, not only was this, you know, his gift to the world, but I mean, its failure was the great disappointment of his life.
And he still holds that.
I mean, I think it was, without being unkind to Jack and without being blunt about it, I think it was kind of the point at which he removed himself from music, certainly from movies. It was really the only film that he was involved with. He actually turned very much to religion and to painting. Some of his paintings do appear in the film as sort of like religious icons in the church, as you'll see.
Have you seen the...
But no, I mean, to pointedly answer your question, it's not something that he finds easy to discuss. But now with it out in the world and the reaction having been overwhelmingly positive,
yeah,
among like crazy cinephiles and film lovers and people who love to similarly dig deep into this kind of weirdo, obscure, lost movie history, people have enjoyed it and people are enjoying it, and like that is the greatest possible reward.
Does it matter if you were alive to see it? I mean, that is always, you know, when a painter dies and then their work becomes monumentally or infinitely more valuable, and then you go, well, is that why they made it? For it to be genuinely a gift, do you need to get that acclaim? Do you need to get that feedback? Or could he just say, well, I made this, I'm proud of it. If people like it, great. If I die and no one knows, oh, well, I made it. You know, like, it seems like it, because it broke him, would he allow himself to come back if there were, like, all these cinephiles paraded up to his house and marched him out of there on their shoulders?
Well, I mean, I think in the case of Jack Good, I think he's, you know, he's, I think, 86 or 87 now. I think he's...
easy to carry on our shoulders.
Well, maybe that's true. I mean, maybe he's not as heavy as, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. But I think he's, you know, he's made up his mind as far as a career is concerned, and actively producing and working on stuff. But he also, you know, doesn't have anything to worry about. He had one of the most remarkable careers in music history that anybody in the United States, Europe, beyond that, has ever had. And so I don't think he has much to worry about. But
see, that's a nice fallback. Like the doomed journey of the, what's his name? Richard Stanley? You know what I'm talking about? Dr. Moreau documentary. Yep. He got broken by it to a level where he just left and like raises goats on a mountaintop now, and doesn't have like a financial sort of bed to fall back on and go, it didn't work out. But
I think the most important question, though, whether it's the case of Jack Good or Richard Stanley, is for each of them, are they happy?
Yeah.
Are they happy in what they're doing now? And I think for both of them, the answer is yes, they are. And for Jack, knowing that the film is out and is finally being seen, I hope that that brings him some joy as well. And I think it does, but it will always be tinged with 40 years worth of some kind of bitterness.
Yeah. Oh, man. I think if in 40 years, if One-Headed Beast was getting traction, I would just be like, oh, go to hell. I think I would just feel like I liked it then and I like it now. And I've brought it up before on this, but like someone, John Cleese was on a show one time talking about, like, he'd be walking down the street and people would go, oh, Monty Python. And they go, yeah. And they go, you know what my favorite sketch was? And he goes, I don't care. And just keeps walking. And that, I think to some degree, if you're creating stuff, you really have to have that. It's nice to get feedback. It's nice to have people say, hey, thanks, that was cool. But man, if you're making stuff only for that reason, that can be really damaging. And so I think it is healthy in some ways. If you're Jack Good and you make it and you go, no one saw it, lost for 40 years. All right, well, we didn't make it for it to become the Titanic of all films. We just made it because we thought it was cool and artsy. Easier to say that for sure.
Yeah, I think you're right in terms of approaching something from solely that perspective. I think that is a totally dangerous way to go about it. But I think... maybe I've understated it, but Catch My Soul was such an unquestionable failure in its time that, I mean, it was, and even the production was complicated for many, many reasons. Again, you know, longer stories than maybe we have time to go into, but it was a very complicated production, complicated release, sat on shelves for decades and decades without any attention.
Yeah, and then was lost from all shelves.
And thought to be totally lost and completely unseeable since it had never come out on home video.
Yeah.
But, you know, once we got in touch with the right people and people who were attached to the production originally and were, you know, in charge of things, they kind of knew where to look and point us in the right direction. And with their assistance, we're able to make something happen that hopefully means something to cinephiles and Jack Good, maybe, and And whoever wants to appreciate it can now, I think is what my perspective is. But again, I guess obsession is the root at all of this.
Well, I'm so curious about your childhood, and I've never seen the movie The Blind Side, but I heard there's this scene in it or something like that where they're about to get in a car accident, and he sort of grabs the kid, the main character grabs the kid and sort of protects him, and then everyone goes, oh, he's a protector. Like, he'll be a great offensive lineman because his natural instinct is to protect people. Mm. And I'm curious about you as a child, you know, not wanting to be the star filmmaker and running around with a camera, shooting everyone, and, you know, coming out with a scarf around your neck to debut to the family and pulling open a curtain. And those things you see in kind of people's home movies. You're like, oh, from the time he was a kid, he's a ham. He always wanted to show himself off in his films. And you seem more like you kind of enjoyed being behind a little bit and elevating other people. And, you know, is that accurate?
Yeah, I think so. I think, although I would not have used the word as a child, I think I've always thought of myself as a curator, mm-hmm. in some sense.
Be a really cool kid, though. Be like, I curate things.
Well, thank you. But I mean, it's kind of what I was doing. You know, for myself, initially, I was curating my selection of movies beyond what was immediately available to me, mm-hmm. in rural Michigan. And sort of looking beyond that to see what else was out there. And, you know, years and years beyond that, professionally, I've curated for, you know, educational institutions and private institutions as well.
And what's your degree in?
It's moving image archive studies. So, I mean, it's basically curatorship.
How many people are in a class like that?
It's a small program. But it's not as myopic as you might think. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people in the program that I was in, and specifically in my year, who were much more interested in things like being that person dark, like deep, deep down in the dark basement.
Yeah.
And like just obsessing over like metadata and like how best to catalog items in the record. And
that's gotta, like, that analysis by paralysis by analysis has gotta happen a lot, where you're like, what are the tag words here? I'm leaning between,
yeah.
How do you it doesn't seem like a job where you could just move on. Or like, got it, we got 8 terms, let's move on.
For me, I mean, that more information studies side of thing is really not my forte. For me, it was maybe more the film history side of things, the film curatorship side of things. I just get really excited when I hear about something that I've never heard of before, and whether it's immediately available or needs to be tracked down in order to be seen or experienced. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just what fuels me, you know. It's just what I get excited about. Like,
I like it.
Just a week or two ago, I heard about a 1989 made-for-TV movie called GoldenEye that is not the GoldenEye that everybody knows. And it is, it's based on Ian Fleming's life. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like an autobiographical dramatized version of Ian Fleming, mm-hmm. and sort of his exploits as, you know, a spy and a provocateur and, you know, a sort of lady romancer.
And, speaking of lady romance, do you have a companion, lady or otherwise?
I don't.
Oh, man, because I picture you being at home, like car guys, how they're always kind of combing through. It used to be like Car Trader, the free, like, mm-hmm. magazine, and then they'd see, you know, a Camaro or something, like, oh, that's a steal, and then just racing out of the house, honey, I got a Camaro. And I picture you the same way, like sitting there combing through, like, GoldenEye 1989, I gotta go, and just racing out, like, that same level
of
passion.
That's kind of how it happens, but without the, really? Without the honey.
So you don't have to be accountable to it. That's nice. You're free to be like, most of my friends that are that passionate about things that would end up in programs, a lot of them either didn't finish schooling because there were no like niche classes like that they could enter into, or they did just what you did and entered into these weird, like, how did you even know that existed? Like, if you're into it, like, you'll just find it. You'll look and find a school that offers it, and you'll get it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sort of in retrospect, I really don't think that I would have totally needed to follow that route, mm-hmm. Meaning, like, I don't think going, you know, from undergraduate into graduate school for this very specific field of study was completely necessary in order to achieve what I was seeking to do with Catch My Soul.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still, you know, happy to have gone through the program and certainly have gained things from it that I am grateful for, both theoretical and historical. But I think really, like, the process of it is just immersing yourself in what is available and out there, and, you know, basically being guided by your own obsessions to a point where you can tangent from one to the other and continue to discover things and sort of endlessly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even tell you now, thinking back, like, how precisely I came to find the GoldenEye television movie. Like,
the good old days. Yeah. You don't get those all the time.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, odd pictures out there, whether they're, you know, 1970s exploitation pictures or late 80s autobiographical TV movies or...
Yeah. Well, I want to get into that more. I feel like it would be a pertinent thing to do would maybe be to, like, watch the movie and then consult. But I think maybe between now and next week, I'll for sure watch the movie and at least comment on it in the interlude portions. But maybe people that listen, where could they find it? How could people join in and watch Catch My Soul?
That's a great question. Catch My Soul is quite literally available anywhere online, from Amazon to the Etiquette Pictures website, which is just etiquettepictures.com. You can also get it on vinegarsyndrome.com as well. But basically any online or in-person retail store would carry this item.
Okay. All right, well, so, try to get Catch My Soul. Watch it. If you do, tweet at @space_cave or me, Huntsberger Junk, and maybe we can chat about it. I have it here, so I have no excuse not to watch it. And I, so you and I will just continue to have a regular talk next week, but I will have seen the movie by then. But I want to find out more. Do you watch the show Detectorists? You seen that at all?
I have not.
It's pretty great. It's just, it's really slow, dry, subtle British humor. And these two guys that carry around metal detectors and go looking for treasure. And that seems like it would resonate with you, that same level of... but I want to get into that. I want to get into... So we'll take a quick break for 1 week and then back with more Samuel B. Prime.
Whee!
So come back for part two next week. I will, between now and then, watch Catch My Soul. That I vow to you. And if you get a chance, watch it as well. It's, like you said, it's on Amazon Prime. And we can all be, I guess... tethered to it next week, or we'll have a common ground on next week's episode. So thanks to Samuel. I enjoyed that beer as well. If you haven't tried it, give it a shot. One-Headed Beast, if you haven't seen it or listened to it, is available on the internet. You can find it at davidhuntsberger.com. It might be coming down off of Vimeo within the next month or so. So if you're procrastinating, get on top of that. Get on top of that. Yeah, sure. Some sort of other verbiage or terminology that means listen to it or watch it. Okay, moving on. Thanks for rating the show, subscribing. Thanks for donating. Oh, I forgot to say that at the beginning. Ryan McWilliams, thanks for donating the money for this episode. Appreciate it. He's someone I've seen at the Junk Show as well, and is doing some music for the 16-second story that we just did. So thank you. And if you donate some money and you want me to read anything in particular, feel free to do that. I'll say it. Or if you say you donate like over $10, put your mailing address. I'll send you something that I feel is worthy of that, of whatever your donation happens to be. People have emailed me to say, like, hey man, I feel a little guilty, so don't worry about rewarding me for the donation. You don't have to feel guilty. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you enjoy the show, and if you do contribute, great, but you don't have to feel guilty if you don't. I got a nice email, I believe James in Australia. I think that was the name. I should have probably looked that up. But just saying that he liked the show. He's going through cancer treatment. And so maybe we can all, as a group, collectively send some positive energy down under and try to tap into that mystical whatever energy that is and send it his way. he said he felt like the space cave had like a little family dynamic to it. I feel that way too. I feel like those of you who I've interacted with all seem like nice people. So glad to be doing the show. I hope and am glad that you're enjoying it. The next Junk Show is June 12th. And I'll be doing a bunch of live shows right after that. Well, and before that, too. I'll be in San Francisco at Cobb's May 24th through 27th with... 27th through 29th, sorry. May 27th through 29th with Al Madrigal. And then after that, I'll be at the Bridgetown Festival in Portland. And then after that, mid-June, I'll be doing a bunch of shows around the Midwest and then up in Minneapolis at Acme, my favorite club, for right before the 4th of July. So, hope to see you guys at that. I think that's about it, you guys. I'm sure I'm forgetting something, but I'll remember it next time. Thanks to Ryan for donating. Thanks to you guys for listening, subscribing, rating. You can listen to tons of stand-up and whatnot on iTunes, everything. You can find it all at davidhunsberger.com. You can donate at thespacecave.com, and you can be one of the call-in people if you follow the space_cave Twitter. All right, let's get out of here. This is another band I saw play at the Treefort Music Festival in Boise, and I really liked them. I think their sound is good. They play like they mean it. And thanks to Eloy for passing along the music. They are out of Detroit, I believe. The name of the band is All Dogs, and they have an album out. You can find it on Bandcamp. There'll be links at thespacecave.com called Kicking Every Day. And this song is called That Kind of Girl. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.